that part of his particular agenda. So I found no references to it. There was a great deal of admiration and exchange between the Nazis and the American eugenicists. It's everywhere. It's there. But in terms of Plecker being involved in anti-Semitic activity,
that's Powell.
Powell, it's interesting. One of his... it's amazing. And pretty much he discounted every influence except the Anglo-Saxon influence in art, cultural influence. Yes, sir.
I wonder if you found any evidence that Plecker was aware on a personal level of the pain that he caused individuals, and if there was any evidence that he ever showed any remorse whatsoever.
I find none. When he resigned, I have a feeling he probably was suggested that he needed to resign at the Bureau of Vital Statistics. In 1946, he was 85 years old. He hung in there. And on the last day on the job, he wrote to John Powell and said, "This is the last batch of copies of letters that I'll be sending you because I'm resigning as of today." But he also explained, "I'm trying to convince the people here that I will stay on for a symbolic fee of $1 a year or whatever as state ethnologist." So no, there was never any remorse that I can find. Any awareness of the disruption, pain that he brought into people's lives.
I just wanted to know, did you look at all at the issue of racial integrity from the perspective of the Indians? That is, you use an example, for example, concerning a Native, an Indian woman who married a white man. Is this an important issue for them, that is the intermarriage with whites? Do they define the child born of a white person and an Indian person at this time as Indian? And the same for those who intermarried with blacks, were they also considered Indian? Or was racial integrity also a very important issue for Indians?
Yeah. Well, the records that I look at, you can see varying designations. Sometimes a child born of an Indian white American would be classified as Indian, or they would wish to have the child classified as white. I suspect, I don't know, but I suspect that sometimes people were looking to escape the harassment. And so they could escape that by giving up their Indian heritage. Some did that. Others, all along, clung to that. They were saying, "I'm an Indian." And you know, I'm looking at it, my sense is that it wasn't a racist thing on the part of these people saying, "I'm not black," right? Because, but it was more, "I want to be what I am," which is Indian. And so it's not, "I don't want to go to the black schools," it's because I want to be what I am.
I suspect it's partly what culture they were living with. If they were living among their own people, among Indian people, they classified themselves as Indians, but if they had merged into the white community, then they would say they're white. Likewise with black and Indian mixtures. If they were Indians, they would say they're Indians. If they merged into the black culture, then they would say they're black.
I was just wondering if you knew what the black people's attitude was of having Indian classified with them. Do you know?
You know, I don't think anybody liked this classification colored. You know, it wasn't until much later in the 20th century that really focused on that. But I think that was robbing everybody. Right? And you began to see, at that time, in some correspondence from Hampton, some of which it was anonymous, from students at Hampton to Powell, outraged at some of the things that were going on. You began to see students referring to themselves as black. 1924, 1925. So, the color designation was something that's foisted onto people, whether they be black or Indian or Philippine. I appreciate your coming. and I appreciate the opportunity to share this story. And thank you, and the foundation, everyone. Powerful story. We have this exhibit, which is sort of crowded in here with the rest of us. Mary Holtgren, one of the curators for the exhibit, is here. It's the story of Indian education at Hampton Institute, then Hampton University now. It's the first off-reservation Indian boarding school in the United States. Virginia Indians were not allowed to attend boarding school. That's correct, isn't it?
No, there's no record that Virginia Indians attended, but there's no record that they were not allowed to. Since the school was receiving federal funds and they were not a federally recognized tribe, that's probably the reason. Although in about 1904 there was a petition by the Pamunkey to enter, and then there was no follow-up that they ever entered. So it's not real clear.
There are catalogs to this exhibit with some essays, and those are available right in the back of the room. You are welcome to take one free today. We also have a series of colloquia here this spring, as we do every semester and during the summer as well. And the schedule is on a sheet that is shaped and looks like this, though not all of them are this color. They vary. The next presentation is on February the 20th by Mary Neff, who's a professor of history at Virginia Tech. And she's going to be talking about gender and the writing of rural history and the family farm. We have an interesting series of guests. All of these people are fellows at the Center for Humanities this spring. And they include a Japanese anthropologist who is a professor at William & Mary talking about the acculturation of Japanese business firms in the state of Virginia and the United States. A Chinese scholar who's a visitor, a professor at a Chinese institution, is going to be talking about Mary Lee Settle and Southern writing. His field is American Southern literature. We have a retired editor and publisher who's been working on Ellen Glasgow, the Thelma Levine, who's a Robinson professor of philosophy at George Mason, and Richard Rorty, who's a Keenan professor at the University of Virginia, who are going to be talking about the tradition of American pragmatism in what is called here a conversation. Some have called it a debate, but they prefer the term conversation. Mitchell Snay, who's a history professor from Ohio at Denison University on Southern separatism, the religion and national identity prior to the Civil War. And then on June the 5th, the last in this series, Brenda Stevenson, who will be a professor of history at UCLA, has been at the University of Texas, on myths and realities of the plantation mistress relationship with slaves. So we welcome you to come back for any and all of these. The schedule is posted over here, and they're available for you to take with you. All of them are at 4 o'clock in this building, with the exception of the one on April the 25th. I do want to thank you for being here. I want to thank you, David, for a very powerful presentation. We look forward to what you will write. To welcome all of you to stay for a brief reception here this afternoon. There's some wine, some soft drinks, some cheese and crackers. And we would love to see you back again. Thank you all for coming.